Chapter 8. Credit versus Bullion and the Cycles of History. Begins with a quote from Geoffrey Gardiner. Bullion is the accessory of war and not of peaceful trade. One might well ask, if our political and legal ideas really are founded on the logic of slavery, then how did we ever eliminate slavery? Of course, a cynic might argue that we haven't, we've just relabeled it. The cynic would have a point. An ancient Greek slave would certainly have seen the distinction between a slave and an indebted wage labourer as, at best, a legalistic nicety. Still, even the elimination of formal chattel slavery has to be considered a remarkable achievement, and it is worthwhile to wonder how it was accomplished, especially since it was not just accomplished once. The truly remarkable thing, if one consults the historical record, is that slavery has been eliminated, or effectively eliminated, many times in human history. In Europe, for instance, the institution largely vanished in the centuries following the collapse of the Roman Empire, an historical achievement rarely recognized by those of us used to referring to these events as the beginning of the Dark Ages. No one is quite sure how it happened. Most agree that the spread of Christianity must have had something to do with it, but that can't have been the direct cause, since the church itself was never explicitly opposed to the institution and in many cases defended it. Instead, the abolition appears to have happened despite the attitudes of both the intellectuals and the political authorities of the time. Yet it did happen, and it had lasting effects. On the popular level, slavery remained so universally detested that even 1,000 years later, when European merchants started trying to revive the trade, they discovered that their compatriots would not countenance slaveholding in their own countries, one reason why planters were eventually obliged to acquire their slaves in Africa and set up plantations in the New World. It is one of the great ironies of history that modern racism, probably the single greatest evil of our last 2 centuries, had to be invented largely because Europeans continued to refuse to listen to the arguments of the intellectuals and jurists, and did not accept that anyone they believed to be a full and equal human being could ever be justifiably enslaved. What's more, the demise of ancient slavery was not limited to Europe. Remarkably, right around the same time, in the years around 600 AD, we find almost exactly the same thing happening in India and China, where, over the course of centuries, amidst much unrest and confusion, chattel slavery largely ceased to exist. What all this suggests is that moments of historical opportunity, moments when meaningful change is possible, follow a distinct, even a cyclical pattern, one that has long been far more coordinated across geographical space than we would ever have imagined. There is a shape to the past, and it is only by understanding it that we can begin to have a sense of the historical opportunities that exist in the present. The easiest way to make these cycles visible is to re-examine exactly the phenomenon we've been concerned with over the course of this book, the history of money, debt, and credit. The moment we begin to map the history of money across the last 5,000 years of Eurasian history, startling patterns begin to emerge. In the case of money, one event stands out above all others, the invention of coinage. Coinage appears to have arisen independently in 3 different places almost simultaneously. On the Great Plain of northern China, in the Ganges River Valley of northeastern India, and in the lands surrounding the Aegean Sea. In each case, between roughly 600 and 500 BC. And this wasn't due to some sudden technological innovation. The technologies used in making the first coins were, in each case, entirely different. It was a social transformation. Why this happened in exactly this way is an historical mystery. But this much we know. For some reason, in Lydia, India, and China, local rulers decided that whatever long-standing credit systems had existed in their kingdoms were no longer adequate, and they began to issue tiny pieces of precious metals. Metals that had previously been used largely in international commerce, in ingot form, and to encourage their subjects to use them in day-to-day transactions. From there, the innovation spread. For more than 1,000 years, states everywhere started issuing their own coinage. But then, right around 600 AD, about the time that slavery was disappearing The whole trend was suddenly thrown into reverse. Cash dried up. Everywhere, there was a movement back to credit once again. If we look at Eurasian history over the course of the last 5,000 years, what we see is a broad alternation between periods dominated by credit money and periods in which gold and silver come to dominate. That is, those during which at least a large share of transactions were conducted with pieces of valuable metal being passed from hand to hand. Why? The single most important factor would appear to be war. Bullion predominates, above all, in periods of generalized violence. There's a very simple reason for that. Gold and silver coins are distinguished from credit arrangements by one spectacular feature. They can be stolen. A debt is, by definition, a record, as well as a relation of trust. Someone accepting gold or silver in exchange for merchandise, on the other hand, need trust nothing more than the accuracy of the scales, the quality of the metal, and the likelihood that someone else will be willing to accept it. In a world where war and the threat of violence are everywhere, and this appears to have been an equally accurate description of the warring states China, Iron Age Greece, and pre-Mauryan India, there are obvious advantages to making one's transactions simple. This is all the more true when dealing with soldiers. On the other hand, soldiers tend to have access to a great deal of loot, much of which consists of gold and silver, and will always seek a way to trade it for the better things in life. On the other, a heavily armed, itinerant soldier is the very definition of a poor credit risk. The economist's barter scenario might be absurd when applied to transactions between neighbors in the same small rural community, but when dealing with a transaction between the resident of such a community and a passing mercenary, it suddenly begins to make a great deal of sense. For much of human history, then, an ingot of gold and silver, stamped or not, has served the same role as a contemporary drug dealer's suitcase full of unmarked bills. An object without a history, valuable because one knows it will be accepted in exchange for other goods just about anywhere, no questions asked. As a result, while credit systems tend to dominate in periods of relative social peace, or across networks of trust, whether created by states, or in most periods, transnational institutions like merchant guilds or communities of faith, in periods characterized by widespread war and plunder, they tend to be replaced by precious metal. What's more, while predatory lending goes on in every period of human history, the resulting debt crises appear to have the most damaging effects at times when money is most easily convertible into cash. As a starting point to any attempt to discern the great rhythms that define the current historical moment, let me propose the following breakdown of Eurasian history, according to the alternation between periods of virtual and metal money. The cycle begins with the age of the first agrarian empires, 3500 to 800 BC, dominated by virtual credit money. This is followed by the Axial Age, 800 BC to 600 AD, which will be covered in the next chapter, and which saw the rise of coinage and a general shift to metal bullion. The Middle Ages, 600 to 1450 AD, which saw a return to virtual credit money, will be covered in Chapter 10. Chapter 11 will cover the next turn of the cycle, the Age of Capitalist Empires, which began around 1450 with a massive planetary switch back to gold and silver bullion, and which could only really be said to have ended in 1971, when Richard Nixon announced that the US dollar would no longer be redeemable in gold. This marked the beginning of yet another phase of virtual money, one which has only just begun, and whose ultimate contours are necessarily invisible. Chapter 12, the final chapter, will be devoted to applying the insights of history to understanding what it might mean and the opportunities it might throw open. Mesopotamia, 3500 to 800 BC. We've already had occasion to note the predominance of credit money in Mesopotamia, the earliest urban civilization that we know about. In the great temple and palace complexes, not only did money serve largely as an accounting measure rather than physically changing hands, merchants and tradespeople developed credit arrangements of their own. Most of these took the physical form of clay tablets, inscribed with some obligation of future payment, and were then sealed inside clay envelopes marked with the borrower's seal. The creditor would keep the envelope as a surety, and it would be broken open upon repayment. In some times or places at least, these bullae appear to have become what we would now call negotiable instruments, since the tablet inside did not simply record a promise to pay the original lender, but was designated to the bearer. In other words, a tablet recording a debt of 5 shekels of silver, at prevailing rates of interest, could circulate as the equivalent of a 5 shekel promissory note, that is, as money. We don't know how often this happened, how many hands such transactions would typically pass through, how many transactions were based on credit, how often merchants actually did weigh out silver in rough chunks to buy and sell their merchandise, or when they were most likely to do so. No doubt, all this varied over time. Promissory notes usually circulated within merchant guilds or between inhabitants of relatively well-off urban neighbourhoods where people knew one another well enough to trust them to be accountable, but not so well that they could rely on one another for more traditional forms of mutual aid. We know even less about the marketplaces frequented by ordinary Mesopotamians, except that tavern keepers operated on credit, and hawkers and operators of market stalls probably did as well. The origins of interest will forever remain obscure, since they preceded the invention of writing. The terminology for interest in most ancient languages is derived from some word for offspring, causing some to speculate that it originates in loans of livestock, but this seems a bit literal-minded. More likely, the first widespread interest-bearing loans were commercial. Temples and palaces would forward wares to merchants and commercial agents, who would then trade them in nearby mountain kingdoms or on trading expeditions overseas. The practice is significant because it implies a fundamental lack of trust. After all, why not simply demand a share in the profits? This seems more fair. A merchant who came back bankrupt would probably have little means of paying anyway, and profit-sharing partnerships of this sort became common practice in the later Middle East. The answer seems to be that profit-sharing partnerships were typically contracted between merchants or anyway people of similar background and experience who had ways of keeping track of one another. Palace or temple bureaucracies and world-roaming merchant adventurers had little in common, and the bureaucrats seem to have concluded that one could not normally expect a merchant returned from a far-off land to be entirely honest about his adventures. A fixed interest rate would render irrelevant whatever elaborate tales of robbery, shipwreck, or attacks by winged snakes or elephants a creative merchant might have concocted. The return was fixed in advance. This connection between borrowing and lying, incidentally, is an important one to history. Herodotus remarked about the Persians, "To tell a lie is considered by them the greatest disgrace, and next to that, to be in debt, especially because they think the one in debt must of necessity tell lies." Later, Herodotus reported a story told to him by a Persian about the origins of the gold that the Persians had acquired in India. They stole it from the nests of giant ants. Jesus' parable about the unforgiving servant makes a joke out of the matter. 10,000 talents, no problem, just give me a little more time. But even here, one can see how such endless falsehoods contributed to a broader sense that a world in which moral relations were conceived as debts is also, while in certain ways entertaining, necessarily a world of corruption, guilt, and sin. By the time of the earliest Sumerian documents, this world may not yet have arrived. Still, the principle of lending at interest, even compound interest, was already familiar to everyone. In 2402 BC, for instance, a royal inscription by King Enmetana of Lagash, one of the earliest we have, complains that his enemy, the king of Ummah, had been occupying a huge stretch of farmland that had rightfully belonged to Lagash for decades. He announces, if one were to calculate the rental fees for all that land, then the interest that would have been due on that rent, compounded annually, it would reveal that Ummah now owes Lagash 4.5 trillion liters of barley. The sum was, as in the parable, intentionally preposterous. It was just an excuse to start a war. Still, he wanted everyone to know that he knew exactly how to do the math. Usury, in the sense of interest-bearing consumer loans, was also well established in Enmetana's time. The king ultimately had his war and won it, and 2 years later, fresh off his victory, he was forced to publish another edict, this one a general debt cancellation within his kingdom. As he later boasted, Quote, he instituted freedom, amargi, in Lagash. He restored the child to its mother, and the mother to her child. He cancelled all interest due. Unquote. This was, in fact, the very first such declaration we have on record, and the first time in history that the word freedom appears in a political document. Enmetanar's text is a bit vague on the details, but a half century later, when his successor, Uruinimgina, declared a general amnesty during the New Year's celebrations of 2350 BC, the terms are all spelled out, and they conform to what was to become typical of such amnesties, cancelling not only all outstanding loans, but all forms of debt servitude, even those based on failure to pay fees or criminal penalties, the only thing accepted being commercial loans. Similar declarations are to be found again and again in Sumerian and later Babylonian and Assyrian records, and always with the same theme, the restoration of justice and equity, the protection of widows and orphans to ensure, as Hammurabi was to put it when he abolished debts in Babylon in 1761 BC, that the strong might not oppress the weak. In the words of Michael Hudson, quote, the designated occasion for clearing Babylonia's financial slate was the New Year festival, celebrated in the spring. Babylonian rulers oversaw the ritual of breaking the tablets, that is, the debt records, restoring economic balance as part of the calendrical renewal of society, along with the rest of nature. Hammurabi and his fellow rulers signalled these proclamations by raising a torch, probably symbolizing the sun god of justice, Shamash, whose principles were supposed to guide wise and fair rulers. Persons held as debt pledges were released to rejoin their families. Other debtors were restored cultivation rights to their customary lands, free of whatever mortgage liens had been accumulated. Unquote. Over the next several thousand years, this same list, cancelling the debts, destroying the records, reallocating the land, was to become the standard list of demands of peasant revolutionaries everywhere. In Mesopotamia, rulers appear to have headed off the possibility of unrest by instituting such reforms themselves, as a grand gesture of cosmic renewal, the recreation of the social universe. In Babylonia, during the same ceremony in which the king reenacts his god Marduk's creation of the physical universe, the history of debt and sin was wiped out, and it was time to begin again. But it's also clear what they saw as the alternative. The world plunged into chaos, with farmers defecting to swell the ranks of nomadic pastoralists, and ultimately, if the breakdown continued, returning to overrun the cities and destroy the existing economic order entirely. Egypt, 2650 to 716 BC. Egypt represents an interesting contrast, since for most of its history, it managed to avoid the development of interest-bearing debt entirely. Egypt was, like Mesopotamia, extraordinarily rich by ancient standards, but it was also a self-contained society, a river running through a desert, and far more centralized than Mesopotamia. The pharaoh was a god, and the state and temple bureaucracies had their hands in everything. There were a dazzling array of taxes and a continual distribution of allotments, wages, and payments from the state. Here, too, money clearly arose as a means of account. The basic unit was the deben, or measure, originally referring to measures of grain, and later of copper or silver. Few records make clear the catch-as-catch-can nature of most transactions. Quote, in the 15th year of Ramesses II, that's around 1275 BC, a merchant offered the Egyptian lady Irenophra a Syrian slave girl whose price, no doubt after bargaining, was fixed at 4 deben, 1 kite, about 373 grams, of silver. Erenofre made up a collection of clothes and blankets to the value of 2 deben and 2 1/3 kite, the details are set out in the record, and then borrowed a miscellany of objects from her neighbours, bronze vessels, a pot of honey, 10 shirts, 10 deben of copper ingots, till the price was made up. Unquote. Most merchants were itinerant, either foreigners or commercial agents for the owners of large estates. There's not much evidence for commercial credit, however. Loans in Egypt were still more likely to take the form of mutual aid between neighbours. Substantial, legally enforceable loans, the kind that can lead to the loss of lands or family members, are documented, but they appear to have been rare, much less pernicious, as the loans did not bear interest. Similarly, we do occasionally hear of debt bond servants, and even debt slaves, but these seem to have been unusual phenomena, and there's no suggestion that matters ever reached crisis proportions, as they so regularly did in Mesopotamia and the Levant. In fact, for the first several thousand years, we seem to be in a somewhat different world, where debt really was a matter of guilt, and treated largely as a criminal matter. Quote, when a debtor failed to repay his debt on time, his creditor could take him to court, where the debtor would be required to promise to pay in full by a specific date. As part of his promise, which was under oath, the debtor also pledged to undergo 100 blows and or repay twice the amount of the original loan if he failed to pay by the date specified. Unquote. The and or is significant. There was no formal distinction between a fine and a beating. In fact, the entire purpose of the oath, rather like the Cretan custom of having a borrower pretend to snatch the money, seems to have been to create the justification for punitive action, so the debtor could be punished as either a perjurer or a thief. By the time of the New Kingdom, 1550 to 1070, there is more evidence for markets, but it's only by the time we reach the Iron Age, just before Egypt was absorbed into the Persian Empire, that we begin to see evidence for Mesopotamian-style debt crises. Greek sources, for instance, record that the pharaoh Bakenranef, who reigned 720 to 715 BC, issued a decree abolishing debt bondage and annulling all outstanding liabilities, since, quote, he felt it would be absurd for a soldier, perhaps at the moment when he was setting forth to fight for his fatherland, to be hauled off to prison by his creditor for an unpaid loan, unquote. Which, if true, is also one of the earliest mentions of a debt prison. Under the Ptolemies, the Greek dynasty that ruled Egypt after Alexander, periodic clean slates had become institutionalized. It's well known that the Rosetta Stone, written both in Greek and Egyptian, proved to be the key that made it possible to translate Egyptian hieroglyphics. Few are aware of what it actually says. The stela was originally raised to announce an amnesty, both for debtors and for prisoners, declared by Ptolemy V in 196 BC. China, 2200 to 771 BC. We can say almost nothing about Bronze Age India, since its writing remains indecipherable, and not much more about early China. What little we do know, mainly culled from dribs and drabs in later literary sources, suggests that the earliest Chinese states were far less bureaucratic than their Western cousins. There being no centralized temple or palace system with priests and administrators managing the storerooms and recording inputs and outputs, there was little incentive to create a single, uniform unit of account. Instead, the evidence suggests a different path, with social currencies of various sorts still holding sway in the countryside and being converted to commercial purposes in dealings between strangers. Later sources recall that early rulers used pearls and jade as their superior method of payment, gold as their middle method of payment, and knives and spades as their lower method of payment. The author can only be talking about gifts here, and hierarchical ones at that. Kings and great magnates rewarding their followers for services, in theory, rendered voluntarily. In most places, long strings of cowrie shells figure prominently. But even here, though we often hear of the cowrie money of early China, and it's easy enough to find texts in which the value of sumptuous gifts are measured in cowries, it's never clear whether people were really carrying them around to buy and sell things in the marketplace. The most likely interpretation is that they were carrying the shells, but for a long time marketplaces themselves were of minor significance. So this use was not nearly as important as the usual uses for social currencies, marriage presents, fines, fees, and tokens of honor. At any rate, all sources insist that there was a wide variety of currencies in circulation. As David Scheidel, one of the premier contemporary scholars of early money, notes, quote, in pre-imperial China, money took the form of cowrie shells, both originals and, increasingly, bronze imitations, tortoise shells, weighed gold, and, rarely, silver bars, and most notably, From at least 1000 BC onward, utensil money in the shape of spade blades and knives made of bronze. Unquote. These were most often used between people who didn't know each other very well, for tabulating debts between neighbors, with local vendors, or with anything having to do with government. People appear to have employed a variety of credit instruments. Later Chinese historians claimed that the earliest of these were knotted strings, rather like the Inca quipu system, and then later notched strips of wood or bamboo. As in Mesopotamia, these appear to have long predated writing. We don't really know when the practice of lending at interest first reached China either, or whether Bronze Age China came to see the same sorts of debt crises as occurred in Mesopotamia. But there are tantalizing hints in later documents. For instance, later Chinese legends about the origin of coinage ascribe the invention to emperors trying to relieve the effects of natural disasters. One early Han text reports, quote, "In ancient times, during the floods of Yu and the droughts of Tang, the common people became so exhausted that they were forced to borrow from one another in order to obtain food and clothing. Emperor Yu coined money for his people from the gold of Mount Li, and Emperor Tang did likewise from the copper of Mount Yan. Therefore, the world called them benevolent." Unquote. Other versions are a little more explicit. The Guanzi, a collection that in early imperial China became the standard primer on political economy, notes there were people who lacked even gruel to eat, and who were forced to sell their children. To rescue these people, Tang coined money. The story is clearly fanciful. The real origins of coined money were at least 1,000 years later, and it's very hard to know what to make of it. Could this reflect a memory of children being taken away as debt sureties? On the face of it, it seems more like starving people selling their children outright, a practice that was later to become commonplace in certain periods of Chinese history. But the juxtaposition of loans and the sale of children is suggestive, especially considering what was happening on the other side of Asia at exactly the same time. The Guanzi later goes on to explain that these same rulers instituted the custom of retaining 30% of the harvest in public granaries for redistribution in emergencies, so as to ensure that this would never happen again. In other words, they began to set up just the kind of bureaucratic storage facilities that, in places like Egypt and Mesopotamia, had been responsible for creating money as a unit of account to begin with.